Thank you for tuning in to the Parent Survival Kit from Surviving to Thriving in Your Household. Today is Real Talk 2, Episode 2, where we talk about 10 and over. So kids, basically 10 and over. We've got some questions the parents have they want to ask, and sometimes they don't know if they should or even who to go to. Right next to me, as always, is my beautiful bride, Dr. Sonia Schwalen, expert pediatric psychologist, nationally certified school psychologist. We also have Dr. Amanda Smith joining us today. We're so thrilled to have you here again for part two.
Yes, thank you for having me.
She's also a pediatric expert psychologist. And today, again, real talk, questions that parents want to ask, but who do I ask? Should I ask them? And sometimes even, should I even have some of these questions? You guys ready?
We're ready.
All right. So as a dad, 17-year-old, 8-year-old, almost 3-year-old in a few days, and also a 1.5-year-old, I've experienced a lot of these questions, and the answers can also not only help me with my 17-year-old, but also with helping me guide my young ones. So if you're a parent out there that has some young ones, this could definitely be a very good episode to listen to. So you can hear some of the things that do happen as your kids get older, questions parents have, and whatnot. So first question is, it kind of goes along the lines of ADD, ADHD, kids at school not really being focused, behavioral issues and whatnot, not knowing how to navigate that. What do I do if I feel like my kid has ADD, ADHD? What is that? Teachers are saying that it may be something that we need to look into. What do we do?
That is a topic I could probably go on about for a long time.
Absolutely.
I always recommend a full ADHD and psychological assessment with like proper testing, qualified professionals that know how to do the testing, a person who actually specializes in that. And the reason for that is because a lot of times pediatricians or even teachers can easily print, you know, from an online source, just free different rating scales that if really me, you, or anyone took them, we may all look like we have some form of ADHD just because those rating scales tend to be very generic and sensitive. And so there's always more information that's needed. A lot of times, too, I find that with kids a lot, especially in the world that we live in today, ADHD symptoms look a lot like symptoms of other disorders, right? Yeah. I know you've
seen
that, too. Anxiety,
trauma, sometimes even eating disorders, mm-hmm. having lack of nourishment.
Depression. I mean, so the key things that, you know, parents will call in a lot and report on are things like, you know, difficulty completing tasks, forgetfulness, procrastination, maybe, I don't know, not turning in assignments. Mm-hmm. All of these things, if you're speaking to a teacher or to a physician, it's very common for them to suspect ADHD. And I will tell you, it's more than half of the clients that will call in for an ADHD assessment that don't even get diagnosed with ADHD, that usually it's something like anxiety or depression or trauma or something else that's going on in the person's life. Yeah. So absolutely get an assessment if you suspect anything to do with attention.
Or, I mean, it could even be learning difficulties where a lot of times these kids would rather act out than be noticed that they're struggling. And so being able to have that evaluation can really help us underpin and underlie what's going on.
Yes, totally. I agree.
So you said a qualified professional. Who is that for the actual testing?
That's a great question. So generally, you want to go see a psychologist who specializes in ADHD testing. So not all psychologists are able to do ADHD assessment or prefer to do ADHD assessment. So you're going to have to really look and find someone who understands ADHD assessment. They know what they're doing, and it's something that's a normal part of their practice.
Okay, excellent. So great advice there. And with that being said, it sounds like there's a lot of misdiagnosing going on from different types of teachers, even us as parents. Sometimes we want to go and we go to WebMD and we diagnose our own selves, our kids and whatnot. There's also a lot of PCPs and even pastors out there that have struggled with labeling or misdiagnosing kids. So how do we navigate that? Is it still the same thing, the getting an assessment done to really find out what's underlying?
Yeah, I would absolutely just reiterate that. The full assessment is going to give all the information in a very comprehensive a comprehensive way so that there are multiple informants on the assessment. So usually a psychologist will take a multi-method, multi-informant approach, meaning they're going to use several different testing measures to be able to arrive at the conclusion on the diagnosis. And then they're going to ask several people to weigh in. So they might ask parents for rating scales and teachers and even other significant people in the child's life. And so we take all that data when we're doing a proper assessment and use it to end up at the diagnostic impressions and then provide the appropriate recommendations.
That sounds great. So it's like the episode we had a few weeks ago, the checkout from the neck up and whatnot.
Yeah, exactly.
Perfect. All right. So next question we have is, it relates to eating. So I know you both love these types of questions as eating disorder specialists and experts. So my kid is a picky eater. What do I do? He only wants to eat chicken and mac and cheese and things like that. So.
All right. It's a loaded question. Number one thing that I find with clients who come in, like parents who come in because they have a child with picky eating, is a very common thread amongst those families is that they always say, like, my instincts or my gut told me this wasn't okay. My kid's been a picky eater for a really long time. I did speak to the pediatrician about it, and the message that I got was that the pediatrician wasn't necessarily concerned or reassured me that this is something that my child would grow out of. And now here we are years later, and they have not grown out of this problem, and it still remains that they eat just a few foods. And it's gotten to the point where it's kind of ruling the family, you know? And so maybe the family's at a point where they're not going out to dinner anymore. They don't enjoy outings. Maybe the mom or the dad is a short order chef and they're making separate meals for every kid in the house. Maybe they've even gotten to a point where they're not eating meals as a family together anymore. And so the first thing that I would want someone to do if they're struggling with picky eating is really take a step back and tap into those instincts again. Because parents, you have instincts. You need to trust them. If something is bothering you about a situation, and not just eating, but any situation with your kid, go ahead and really tap into that and feel into it. If you're so concerned about it, it's something that's nagging at you, you don't necessarily see it's getting any better, then absolutely go ahead and call us. You know, if you're in the area, give us a call. We can do a consult and then set you up for an assessment. Or get help from a pediatric psychologist that can at least do an assessment and hopefully point you in the right direction to get the services that you need. That's what I would say. What do you think, Dr. Smith?
Yeah, I think especially when you start noticing how it's impacting other things, right? It may not be necessarily impacting lab work or, their growth charts, but if it's significantly impacting the family, that's something to be a little bit more concerned about and be really thoughtful of, hey, am I noticing something that I need some extra help with? And that's absolutely fine to be able to ask for help.
Yeah. And then, you know, I don't want parents to mistake like chronic picky eating with what's developmentally appropriate as well, because it also depends on the child's age and maybe just a phase that they're going through, because that is a very real thing. Toddlers especially and younger kids will exert control in many different areas of their life, and choosing not to eat certain foods is one way that they'll do that when they're younger. But if your child is, you know, 10 and up in terms of the population that we're talking about today, and they've been a chronic picky eater, I would say go ahead and set up an assessment with a psychologist.
That's great advice. And we also have the Red Clinic podcast that Dr. Schwalen hosts, which has great information regarding some different types of eating disorders and picky eating and whatnot, that you should definitely check out if you have some concerns regarding any type of eating disorders or questions regarding eating habits. So to dive into some more of these eating habits, there's a lot of fad diets going out there. And among teens, a lot of teens are trying to look a certain way because of social media, what's being presented out there in the public and the image and whatnot. So my daughter wants to do a juice diet only to lose weight. What do we do? What are our thoughts? Should we allow it?
Okay, that's it. That's the question.
That's the question.
Should we allow it?
Is it safe? I mean,
I think by starting to have a conversation with your daughter of why. Why is this decision she's wanting to make? What's going on that's causing her to think that this might be helpful? Diets and fads, we can literally go on for a whole nother hour about that. Our dieting industry is a multi-billion dollar industry. So understanding that and how that impacts us and how it influences us as people is really important to understand. But I think especially if you're noticing that your child is wanting to do these different diets, kind of understanding a little bit why and helping them seek services of being able to help and address that, whether it's like, well, I think this is what's right for my body. It's like, okay, well, let's go and meet with a dietitian that can help you understand what is right for your body.
And then just to kind of piggyback off of what Dr. Smith said and to just be very direct, because the question was very direct, I would say, no, you don't allow it. And then, you know, you go along with what Dr. Smith was saying is have that conversation with your child. Like, what's behind this? What's the deeper meaning behind even wanting to go on a juice diet? And the reason I say no is because there's way too many factors involved. Okay. So when you're dealing with a child, they are living in a body that has to grow. It's a growing body. That's just what is going on with them at a very young age. And depriving a child of that much nutrition without any guidance or any real reason except your child wants to follow some fad diet is not ever a good idea. And so then once you find out the why behind it and get a deeper understanding on it, you can take the next steps to help your child get the help if they need it with a psychologist or a dietitian that has some background and expertise in disordered eating or eating disorders and understands diet culture. But if there was a client sitting in front of me right now and they were saying, my 10-year-old wants to juice for the next week, I would say be very, very careful with that. And it's okay to follow your gut instinct.
If or your my gut 17-year-old. Is a no,
go with it. Yeah. Or my 17-year-old.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know many 10-year-olds that are trying to do a juice diet, but there's so many advertisements going on. I mean, just listen to the radio. They're advertising like crazy. They can be delivered to your doorstep nowadays. It's the new big thing, and it's not even just for a diet. It's a cleanse. Like, my body's going to cleanse from this juice type of diet thing. So definitely some big questions out there regarding that. My kid also is obsessed with sports. They're a star athlete, whether it's gymnastics or football or baseball, whatever it may be, and they're on this very strict diet that they have come up with. They will only eat the leanest chicken and this, you know, broccoli, whatever it may be. They're on this very strict diet. Should I be concerned with that type of obsession of the diet and the exercise and whatnot?
So, I mean, I'm sure you're going to reiterate this, Dr. Smith, but the word that really stands out to me is that obsession, right? So again, you want to take a step back and really look at this, because kids, you know, when they're really motivated to do well in sports, especially, and they might have some guidance from a dietitian or a physician or whatever it may be, or even a coach, because sometimes I know high school coaches will try to guide kids on what to eat and what not to eat in order to enhance performance. The word obsession is really what stands out to me. So take a step back and really tune into that concern. Because when I hear the word obsession, I do get very concerned. It sounds more like it's a compulsion that the kid may not be able to stop themselves from doing it, or they feel very, very compelled to just eat those certain foods. If it feels like it's impacting your child's functioning, so maybe it's like all they can think about, or they spend time avoiding social situations like going out for dinner or attending a birthday party or something because they know they're not going to get the food on their meal plan that they need for their diet or whatever it may be, those are red flags. Those are things that are concerning. And so always as a parent, you want to think like, how much is this affecting their everyday life? How much is it taking over? And if you're coming up with, this is just having a major effect on my child's life and their whole sense of normalcy, then I would say go ahead and get them in for an assessment.
And I actually picked up on a different part. It said on their own. So like not with the guidance of professionals, right? So like on their own, obsession, those are two things that it's like kind of saying, okay, this is really about them, not necessarily what may be best for the goals that they're trying to achieve.
Sure. Well, and as a dad and also as a coach myself, when you have star athletes or kids who want to, you know, excel in different sports, it's very easy to look at pro athletes and whatnot, even college athletes, different programs, and see what type of diet some of these players are on.
Yeah.
Some of these, you know, figures out there that are in the community and trying to just follow what they're doing. And what children don't know, obviously, is that there's a lot of structure and professional guidance and expertise behind that. So definitely some good advice there as well. All right. So we're going to move on to, some heavier topics a little bit. This one is, there's a few questions regarding curfew and bedtime. So I know we're talking about 10-year-old and up. So more so teens, should I have a bedtime for my kid who's in high school?
That's a question, huh?
That's one of the questions.
I think it, once again, that kind of like depends on every kid, you know, understanding like, does this kid naturally have their own bedtime? Are they needing more structure? Are they getting enough sleep? Are they not getting enough sleep? What are you noticing as a parent in their behaviors, how they're acting? Is there, you know, a consistent schedule of them sleeping? Is there not a consistent schedule of them sleeping? If not, why? What is going on there?
So my kid likes to stay up and play video games, and it's hard to get them off.
Yeah, so that's one example. So there's a lot of different rabbit holes we could go down with the whole video game situation. You know, just a general recommendation is, well, where are the video games and the televisions located? Are they in the bedroom? That may be one thing that you need to consider in terms of removing technology from the space that the child sleeps in. Usually that's like where we'll start if we're working with clients on that issue. And then the structure and the need for more consistency, it just depends on the child. But I would also say it depends on the parents too. So parents, it also depends on like what kind of culture you're trying to set up in the home. If you know that you and your spouse need some downtime and you just need some, you know, peace and quiet in the home, you want the common areas to be empty by a certain time so you don't have to keep cleaning up. You can have the lights turned down. You can go to your own room and relax. Then go ahead and set that up. You know, you can, it's all about what works for you as a family as well. If you think, you know, by 9 p.m., everyone should at least be in their room, but then lights out by 10, you know, whatever it is. But I think, you know, like Dr. Smith said, it really depends on the child, what they need, how much structure they need, how much sleep they're getting, and then also just also what works for you as a family.
Okay. And with along those lines, retreating to the room, for example, I know a lot of us have TVs in our rooms as kids. I know growing up, I had a TV in my room as a kid. What are the concerns for me as a dad of my kid falling asleep to the TV being on and whatnot? They retreat to the room. They're never an issue. They go to bed. You know, they're in the bed by 9, but they're watching TV, and I don't really know what time they're really going to sleep. Not much problem waking up, but I know they're going to sleep with the TV on because sometimes I go and check on them, and the TV's still on, and they're sleeping. Is that a concern?
I mean, for the most part, I think it is a concern just because we know that screen time is something that we're always working hard to reduce. And we don't want to set kids up to always have background noise or the lull of the TV, right? Or the light in the room even, to be able to fall asleep. What we want to do is we want to start as early as we can to help kids learn that they need to start falling asleep on their own. They know they have everything they need inside of them to self-soothe. We want them to kind of ultimately take that act of faith and let themselves fall asleep. So I like to actually recommend that parents, if they're going to send their child to the room, for example, for 9 p.m., that access to screens and all of that turn down at least 30 minutes before sleeping time. So they can read a book or take a shower or do some other kind of activity that does not involve looking at a screen until they fall asleep.
Yeah. And it's also a little bit different when it comes to, like, I think background noise, whether it's a sound machine versus a TV. TVs right. actually can keep your brain active because of the words and the different, like, noise. I don't know what it's called, enunciation. I don't know what it is. But that can be very different than having, like, a sound machine. If your kid is like, hey, like, it's really hard for me to fall asleep in the silence, a sound machine might be something to look into. But that can often change the way that our brain is sleeping and having that quality sleep that they need.
Yep.
Yeah, and one thing that we've done with our 17-year-old, which has been very helpful, is we kind of started encouraging him to scribe in his journal, to even start journaling at night before bed. And that way he can release all of his thoughts and it kind of empties the brain a little bit, and then he's able to go to sleep much easier. A long curfew. So my kid makes curfew or breaks curfew, either or. And if they make curfew, they sneak out at night. So when it comes to curfew, breaking curfew, sneaking out, I'm fed up as a parent. I don't know what to do. Do I ground them? How do I ground them? I'm concerned about what they're doing, being in trouble and whatnot, obviously. So as a parent, I know that when I was a kid, I did it sometimes. Should I be concerned? Should I really be concerned? Or is it just normal part of just development?
What do you think, Dr. Smith?
I feel like that's a loaded question. What are all the like components of that question?
Let's just break it down. Okay, so regarding curfew, what's the question? Should a child have a curfew or?
Yes. Well, should my kid have a curfew?
So setting guidelines for kids for every situation will always help them be more successful. Okay, and no matter how old your child is, they always want to know what they need to do in order to get your approval or to maintain a positive parent-child interaction. So guidelines are always helpful. Just think of a curfew as one of those guidelines as, hey, if we're going to let you go out and be with friends, this is what we need from you in return. And one of those is, like, you need to be home at this time. I always tell parents, you know, use the guideline along, like, what's legal, first of all, in your city. So make sure you're not setting a curfew that's later than that time, because you don't want to set your child up to be in legal trouble. And then go ahead and make that decision together as parents in terms of whatever you're comfortable with or what works for your family. There are some parents who have to work on a Saturday morning and they don't want to be up until midnight on a Friday night, right? And so if it doesn't work for you to wait up for your child until midnight, adjust the time. I mean, that's just part of family life. You know, we all have to make sacrifices and work together in order to make family life work for all of us. The question about my kid is sneaking out, you know, there's a lot that's probably contributing to a situation like that. And I would want to know more. You know, that's just kind of one of those situations where it's hard to say what to do or give any kind of recommendation, because there's probably more going on there. It sounds like there's trust issues. Maybe there's a breakdown in communication. Maybe there's people in the family not feeling understood. Who knows?
Peer pressure. I mean, there's a lot of things.
Yeah. Peer pressure. Exactly. We don't really know what the kids are going through, what the parents are going through, and what they've done to address it so far. And so if it's an ongoing issue that's causing a lot of conflict and it doesn't seem like anything you're doing is working, pick up the phone and get a professional involved. I mean, it could literally be just a few handful of sessions and you may be able to work through it. But at least, you know, you get someone else involved and you can find a solution.
And it sounds like the key thing is the conversation part of it. Just talking to your kids. I mean, even what is the curfew? 12 o'clock. Okay, so what are you going to be doing between 9 and 12 that's so important as well, right? Because I know growing up, even in my 20s, I had friends and people, and we had a saying, nothing good ever happens after 12. So, right? So as a teenager with teenagers out there, what good could possibly happen after 10 o'clock, right? I mean, let's just be real. So that conversation part sounds like it's very important.
Yeah, and having like a conversation of what's the point of us putting in a curfew? Why? Why are we placing in a curfew? Why is that important? You know, helping kids understand that versus letting them just create their own assumptions of what they think a curfew is meant to be.
Okay. Well, and it sounds like also even having even potential reasons, like I have to work tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. on a Saturday. There's things that we have as adults that we have responsibilities for. So we have our own curfew that we develop in our head based on what the next day looks like. And it sounds like having those conversations could actually be very developmental for our teens.
And, you know, I've said this before on previous episodes. It's not a conflict, right? We don't want to ever set it up as a conflict. Like Dr. Smith is talking about, like, give explanation, help them understand the reasoning behind it, bring them along in that understanding. And then also, it's all about how you kind of sell it, right? To any kid, any age. The answer is yes. You can go out. You can be with your friends. And I need you home by 10, right?
But that's not fair. My friends get to stay out until 12 o'clock every night of the week. And that's not fair.
Yeah. And it's hard, right? So you can kind of empathize with your child on that, like, FOMO, that fear of missing out. So there's 2 more hours that your friends are going to be out without you that you may not be a part of that. Let's talk about that. Let's navigate that. You know, maybe you can call them the next day and get some pictures or talk about stories or whatever it might be. Or maybe there's a compromise at 10 o'clock. You guys can come over to our house, but we just don't want you out. Like, there's ways around it. You know, there's ways to talk about it and to help the child feel like you understand them. That's usually what it is with teenagers. They just feel judged or constricted and they don't really know why. But if you can enter their world a little bit and let them know that you care about why it matters to them, that opens up a lot of conversation.
That's great advice. All right. So speaking of curfews, we're going to dive into some really deep questions now. So a lot of times kids are wanting to stay out past curfew or later and later because they're out with friends, they're out drinking, they're experimenting with drugs. Should I have a zero tolerance rule, number one? Because I know a lot of parents actually say, well, you know what? As long as they're drinking at my house, I know they're safe. I know they're protected. They're going to experiment whether it's at my house or somewhere else. I'd rather them do it at my house. What should parents have as far as their stance on drinking, experimenting with drugs? Where do we go?
Yeah. What do you think, Dr. Smith?
I was going to ask you the same question. That one is definitely a real talk question.
I have met parents, you know, in clinic where they have polar opposite ends of a stance on this topic. So I've met parents who say, well, my child goes to school with other kids where the entire culture is that everybody just smokes marijuana or has a few drinks on the weekends. And they're 15 and 16, 17, 18 years old, right? And so because my kid goes to a school like that, we as parents have just decided that we're going to tolerate it because we'd rather them doing these things in our home under our supervision than feeling like they have to do it in private. But then when you ask the parents, which I will, and I always do, let's not talk about what the other parents think, and let's not talk about what the other kids are doing. What are you okay with? And almost 100% of the time, the parents will say, I hate that this is my kid's situation. I never was able to do these things when I was younger, or I struggled with drug use or alcoholism at one point in my life, and I'm so scared that my child is going to go through that themselves. I'm scared to put limits down because if I do, I'm going to lose them. You know, something along those lines. So there's a lot behind why the parents are going along with it. When I'm able to understand some more of that, I'm able to help them realize that, you know, it's okay that they feel the way they do. They don't necessarily have to go along with the in crowd and conform just because all the other kids' parents are or whatever it may be. I also hear the opposite end where parents are adamantly against it, you know. Even vaping, you know, which is the replacement for smoking cigarettes these days, parents will say substance abuse runs in our family. And I know my 17 or 18 year old is vaping. That's a no. It's a huge no because it's like one of those gateway situations where my kid is going to become dependent on a substance. And I'm deathly afraid of that. And then that situation sets them up for conflict and rebellion and just so much misunderstanding in the parent-child relationship. So again, it goes both ways. And then I also meet parents that are like, I'm fine with it. You know, I did that when I was younger and I'm fine and nothing ever happened. And so everybody has their own perspective on this. As the professional, if I'm working with a family in any of these situations, I'm going to first want to understand what are the values in the family system around this. If parents are really not okay with it, but they're just kind of going along with it, I'm going to really explore that with them and help them come to the decision to really honor their beliefs and their values as a parenting unit and as a family system. If that means they need to make hard decisions, you know, down the road of removing that child from that school or moving to a new home or neighborhood or whatever it may be, those are topics that we will explore. Because I always want to get families living their best life, meaning they need to feel good about how they're raising their children despite what the world may be telling them or urging them to do. If there's a situation where kids are involved in using drugs and alcohol and the parents are adamantly against it, I'm going to work with the family unit to really find a way to communicate about that and then explore, you know, what's really going on with this child. Is it peer pressure that's making them feel like they need to do this? Is it something they feel like they're addicted and they can't, and they really truly need help in a different way with substance abuse or addiction treatment? You know, there's always more that we can do and explore to get the child the help that they need. I always also caution parents to understand, like, if they're breaking the law, they're allowing kids that are underage to drink in their home or do drugs in their home. They are putting themselves at risk, and they need to be educated on that. They need to know exactly what they're at risk for so that they can make very informed decisions. Because if at any time someone catches wind of what's going on, CPS can be called. That's Child Protective Services in this state. It can be something else in some other states. You know, sometimes as mandated reporters, if we're afraid for a child's safety, we will let the families know. So there's a lot of risk involved when certain things are being supported
or permitted.
Yeah, or permitted just because parents may not be thinking on their own or feeling like they're making their own decisions. So it's a heavy question, and there's a lot to consider.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think one of the things that you talked about was just like getting yourself educated on how those decisions can impact you, really understanding what your values are, what is really going on with your child that this could lead to use of alcohol or drugs, and exploring all of those to be able to help figure out and navigate the best thing that they can do for their family.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah, and it reminds me of one of my favorite Bible verses, Romans 12:2. Do not conform to the ways of this world, but be renewed by the Holy Spirit. And, you know, parents do say a lot. I hear it all the time. You know, my kid's going to do it anyway. You know, that is true. I mean, as a kid growing up, my dad did not permit any of that happening in our household. And if we got caught, we'd be in very, very serious trouble. And my dad was not someone you wanted to reckon with, I promise you. But there's always going to be experiments with different things with kids, right? The one thing I like to think about, and we kind of joked around some different things earlier before this podcast, but if you have structure and discipline in your household and your kid knows what is and is not permitted, at least they know that on one shoulder they have the angel, the other shoulder they have the devil, and they're talking back and forth. You can do it, peer pressure, everyone's doing it, it's okay. It's just one drink, you know, this and that. But that actually helps us navigate as kids to really learn right and wrong and to make better decisions. So even if we do experiment here and there, we do understand that, you know, there is that fear, and that fear is really important, I believe, for kids, just as far as like judgment and whatnot. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't necessarily know that it's fear. It's more of, I don't want to let my mom or dad down, because kids, you know, no matter what they're going through, they want to feel understood. They want to feel, like they have approval. Even teenagers want that.
And they
want to
fit in also.
They may not do anything to let on to that.
Right.
But they also want to fit in socially, especially teenagers, because they're really navigating their own social development and trying to find their identity. And so the types of conversations that I usually encourage are, if you ever find yourself in this situation, these are the things you can do, right? So a mom and a dad sitting down with their child and saying, look, We know that kids do drugs. We know that. We know you're probably going to be in situations where you might be exposed to drug use. You might be asked to use drugs or offered some alcohol or whatever it may be. What are you, where do you stand on that? What, how would you navigate that? You know, let your child kind of tell you what their thoughts are. And then you let them know, these are the things that you can do also to call on us if you ever need help in those situations. So I know a lot of parents that will come up with like a signal word or like some kind of code where the kid will call in the middle of being at a party and say whatever the code word is, and parents know, I have to go pick them up now. Or it's like a code text or something like that because they're afraid their friends might overhear a conversation. So that's a recommendation. Another, you know, recommendation is if your child is already involved with drugs and alcohol and it really is an issue, then get professional help. You know, always seek that professional help because it is available and very useful in the right situations. And so I want to always encourage parents to consider those types of outlets to get some help. Anything you want to add?
No, you said it really well.
Thank you, Dr. Smith.
So talking about experimenting, you know, drugs and alcohol and everything else, one thing that's very, very normal in development for kids is experimenting with their own sexuality and whatnot. So we've had some parents that have asked questions regarding, you know, sex and I've caught my kid masturbating and I don't know how to react. I don't know what I should say to my kid. I don't know how to have a conversation with them about what I just experienced or whatnot. What do we do when our kid is, and we know our kid is masturbating?
Okay. You want to take that one?
I think this is something that a lot of parents will get really concerned about. I think one is just understanding that, you know, I think just the way many people grew up was that's something we don't talk about. And as our now kids are growing up, there's so much more information when it comes to the internet and things like that. And I think one of the big things is really trying to help not create a culture of shame around it and being able to have that open conversation, even though it may be a little bit uncomfortable, and understanding how to talk to your child about it based on y'all's values as a family, because each family is going to have different values and different thoughts around what the action means. And so being able to help explore, but also, once again, I think we talked about this last week, was if you're not talking to your child about it, they're going to be learning that information elsewhere.
Yeah, I agree. You know, really reducing the shame and then also creating a space where you can have open conversations about it. You know, this, even the experimenting, like you said, experimenting their sexuality or exploring their sexuality, because that's something different, right? That could be where I've heard children go to their parents at the age of 13 or 14 and say, Mom, I'm bisexual, right? And we hear all the time that kids are, it's very, very normal for kids to think that or be attracted to the opposite sex, or it's just really part of their development in terms of exploring their sexuality. So you ask two separate questions. So number one, take the shame out of the conversation, be able to just approach it like, hey, you know, I know this is happening. Let's talk about how to do this safely. Make sure you're in a private place. You're not just doing it openly. Like, talk about some like socially appropriate, like parameters yeah. about it. If that's within your value system, if it's not, then find a way to communicate that to your child, but also without shaming them. And then exploring sexuality. Whenever I'm talking to parents about this, I always just say, let's take a step back, right? Your child is not someone who may have all these like preconceived notions of what being gay or bisexual or pansexual or whatever it is. You know, they don't have all these preconceived notions of what that means in this world. They're young, they're learning the ways of the world right now. They're going to take your lead. And if you set it up so that they feel like they cannot talk to you about certain topics, they will find ways to continue to explore the questions that they have and not include you. And so this is where the real hard work comes in as a parent, because even if you have your own views or preconceived notions about a topic like this, I'm basically calling all parents to like put that to the side and become very curious about your child. Hey, what is this about? Why do you think you're saying that? You know, tell me more, say more about that. And learn before you just shoot it down or tell your kid what to think or how to behave. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I always say for this topic specifically is that all people are sexual, okay? That's just a part of being a human being. And so, you know, someone's not asexual or bisexual or homosexual or heterosexual. We're just sexual. And for kids who are developing, that's what it is. They're just sexual. They're trying to figure that out, and they're trying to understand what that means for them. So in the beginning, when they're saying some of those things at a very young age, they're just trying it on, usually, okay? And they're trying to, they take in a lot of information, like based on how people react to them or where they're getting the acceptance from or what feels good for them at a young age, right? When they get a little bit older, it's different, but I'm talking about younger. The younger a person is, when, because I'm hearing this, this is starting as early as like 8, 9 years old, where kids will say things like that, and parents get so nervous, like, hands off, I don't know what to do.
And I think the acceptance is a big themselves. Part of that, too, that you mentioned.
What is?
The acceptance. They're finding acceptance somewhere.
It can be a part of that, especially if mom and dad are completely rejecting me because I said this thing. Now I'm even more interested to know why this is so off limits versus, okay, just say more about that. Let's learn about this together. What does this mean for you? What, you know, there's no need to just get so scared of it when it's just like every part of their development. It's just something that they're going to go through, just like every other aspect of who they are. And you can help support them and open up conversation about it in a non-judgmental and curious manner.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And it kind of goes into some of the other questions that have come up on this topic is, you know, things like, I know my daughter, for example, is having sex. And my wife and I are at different ends as far as how we should approach this. So my wife wants to say, well, we should let her be on birth control so at least she doesn't get pregnant. And I'm like, well, no, she doesn't need to be having sex at all. So how do we navigate some of these things? Because these are real questions that parents are having and whatnot. And, you know, we all want the best for our kid. We want them to have a successful life. And if they're going to experiment, if they're going to explore, if they're going to try things on, at least let's have them protected to where they don't ruin necessarily their entire life or change the projection of where their life could go because there's, you know, a pregnancy or something else that happens.
I think what's awesome is are those parents are having that conversation. I think that's really the important part. It's really hard when parents are not on the same page. And so if y'all aren't able to come to a conclusion on what you feel like is best, just with you two, then sometimes those things can get really emotional for parents to discuss, especially when you're on opposite sides and it sounds like there's a lot of fear going on, right? Like, I want my child to be on birth control because I want to make sure that, you know, their future is protected, right? That underlying like desire for the future to be protected, there's a beautiful thing in that, right? And so being able to help have someone that can come jump in and help navigate those conversations can be really helpful for those parents to continue to make the best decision for their family.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. It's kind of like having that knowledge also, just, you know, growing up as a kid, I used to watch G.I. Joe and knowing was half the battle. Mm-hmm. And it sounds to me like the reoccurring theme here is conversations with kids, really trying to find out what's going on in their life from their perspective, not judging, not shaming, and then just that information and then openness allows us to really help them navigate and sometimes with help when needed to really help make the best decisions. I think it's really important also to kind of talk to parents about understanding like some legal ramifications for some things that kids may be experimenting or trying. You know, when it does come to, as we mentioned, drugs and alcohol, there could be some serious legal concerns there, not just for the parents, but also for the kids. If something bad happened, drinking and driving and whatnot, if somebody got hurt, there definitely could be some life-changing events that can occur from that. with sex, and we talked about sexting and all this stuff on a previous episode, but even with sex, there could be charges that are placed by the, you know, one of the parents, you know, that my kid was raped, when maybe it wasn't really the true case, but parents get involved, they want to do, you know, certain things, and we hear this a lot, you know, allegations that are made. So I think it's really important that we do have these conversations with our kids also about, if you are doing this, these are the things that could also happen. How do we approach those conversations with our kids to where at least we listen to them, but we also make them aware of every action does have a consequence, and that could be a bad consequence in some cases.
I mean, that's it. You just talk to them about it, and you don't hold anything back per se. I mean, you do it in an age appropriate manner. You do it in a way to help them understand what you're trying to say, because the more and more you push them in a direction of feeling like you don't understand them or you're not willing to listen because it's your way or the highway per se, right? You're going to lose them. And so the older the child is, you know, usually around 14 to 18 years old, you really want to start including them in on what, like the why behind what you're saying. And that you always have their best interest at heart. Like what Dr. Smith was saying, you know, there's something really amazing about the fact that you're trying to protect their future. Like that's the true intention behind it, and allowing them to hear that and allowing them to understand that you really don't have anything but their best interest in mind. This is not to shame them. This is not to criticize. This is to help them navigate how to successfully make good decisions in a really difficult situation.
And just even so, like, I think sometimes these conversations can get really hard, even for parents. It can be very triggering. You can get really caught up in the, I really want the conversation to go this way, or I want my child to react this way, because we're human too. And so it's also okay to be able to ask for help, ask for professional help on how to best talk with your child, because it is really hard. It is really triggering. And a lot of times our kids bring up some of those biggest emotions that we have. And it's okay to tell your child, like, hey, like, I want to have these conversations with you, but I think I need help on figuring out how to have this conversation with you. And being able to set up that example is going to put your kid in such a better place of them recognizing, oh, like, my parent recognizes they're not always perfect and they're going to be able to ask for help. That means I can ask for help for these things later on as well.
Yeah, that's good advice. I know as parents, we always want to, especially even with Gino and my son, just he came to us not too long ago because he wanted to get his ears pierced. And all I wanted to do was just tell him all the reasons why, or all the things he should think about. So I had the best intentions, but all I did was talk and tell him, you know, me growing up, and here's what it looked like when I was growing up, and I had my ears pierced, and here's what you should think about, and all these things. At the end of the day, it's really more about where are they coming from and being a part of their world. The one thing that is very, very hard to navigate is our kids, especially as they get into their teenage years, they know everything and whatnot. So in closing, I just want to kind of sum it all up. So with all these different types of questions, some were serious, some were extremely serious, some are very, very hard to speak about. The bottom line is, to sum it all up, what's the best thing we can do for our kids to navigate these questions and really let them know how much we care and that we're really there for their best interest?
You want to go or should I?
I think, once again, just having those open conversations. I think that's like a big key, and recognizing your own emotions as a parent in those conversations is going to be key as well. Being able to regulate yourself, being able to figure out how to best communicate is going to help your kids set up and be able to see that you're really trying. And if you're struggling with that, it's okay to ask for help too.
And it's also okay to think what you think, because you have really good instincts as a parent, and to trust your instincts as well. And so if you feel like, you know, this is just one of those really difficult things that we're not able to talk about, to reach out and get that help.
So it's okay to have rules. Definitely can have conversations with our kids. You know, just doing everything we can to show them how much we love them. We are going to, our next episode is going to be Real Talk Live. It's going to be a Facebook Live. We're going to have both of you up here as a panel of psychologists with Dr. Lewis, who's going to be joining us. So we're going to have three expert psychologists, and we're going to open it up to Facebook Live. So if you have questions you want answers to, if you want to touch base with one of our psychologists to get some information on things you're navigating, because everyone goes through different things at different times. There's a lot going on out there in the world with COVID and everything else going on. Join us December 16th at 1:30 p.m. Facebook Live, Real Talk Live. Thanks for joining us today. We look forward to seeing you next time.